Previously on Beta.
This makes him a frightening, but also a very attractive figure.
Yeah, I think we all are.
Would you like to know more?
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Sam Phillips joins us today to talk about her album, World on Sticks.
I started thinking, I wonder if this tree is in pain. I wonder how he feels. And it was funny because as soon as it started raining, he seemed happier.
And the fast and the very, very furious road rage.
I would never comment on someone's physical attributes in real life, but in the confines of a car, you're sort of protected and all bets are off.
Brian Smith tells us why getting behind the wheel brings out our inner Mr. Hyde. Plus, we'll explore the history of hidden tracks with TDM's Ernie Smith. One of the funniest writers in America is Simon Rich. Simon has written for Saturday Night Live and Pixar, but he's probably best known for his hilarious short stories. His latest collection is called Hits and Misses. It's inspired by Simon's real experiences in Hollywood.
The first story is about a struggling novelist. His wife is pregnant, and he's trying to finish up his novel before the baby is born because he realizes, you know, when that happens, he's not going to have as much time to focus on his writing. As he's working on it, he checks the sonogram, and he notices two things about his unborn child. One is there's a penis, so he knows that it's going to be a boy, but then there's also a pencil. And the doctor explains that that means that he's going to give birth to a writer.
Yeah.
And everybody else is pretty excited about it, but he, as a struggling writer himself, can't help but feel increasingly competitive with his unborn child, who is, from within the womb, writing what turns out to not just be a good novel, but possibly the great American novel.
Yeah. Yeah. Now would be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from The Baby.
Sure thing. Okay. Dr. Kowalski was his usual upbeat self as he booted up the high-tech 4D scanner. But when he put on his glasses and squinted at the screen, his face went slack. "My God," he murmured softly. "My God in heaven." "What's wrong?" Sue asked the doctor. Dr. Kowalski swiveled around and laughed. "I'm sorry," he said. "Everything is fine with baby health. It is just this thing fetus is writing. It is so engrossing." He shook his head with amazement. "I forgot there were other people in room. Until you spoke, I was just, like, in it." Sue exhaled with relief. She tried to squeeze Ben's hand, but his fingers were limp. He leapt up and hurried toward the scanner. "How did he get that typewriter?" he asked. Dr. Kowalski shrugged. "Is normal at 25 weeks. Ben was disturbed to notice that the fetus was using a hip vintage Underwood. He was almost certainly a novelist and probably a literary one. "What's he writing?" he asked, trying to sound casual. "His historical novel," said Dr. Kowalski, "about General Custer." Ben's heart raced. "He's writing about General Custer?" "Yes," said the doctor, "but it is about so much more than that. It is suspenseful, lyrical. In some ways, it is a story of America itself." "Wow," Sue said. "That sounds pretty good. Right, honey? Right?" "He stole my idea," Ben murmured as they climbed up to their fifth-floor Brooklyn walk-up. "How is that even possible?" Sue asked. She was exhausted and a little out of breath. "They can hear stuff through the womb," Ben said. "He must have heard me talking about it or something." "But you never talk about your work," Sue reasoned. "I mean, until today, I had no idea you were starting a book about General Custer." "I'm not starting it. I'm finishing it. I'm up to the last chapter, damn it." "It's going to be fine," she said soothingly. "There can be two books about the same thing, right?" But Ben had already bounded up the stairs, leaving her to walk up the final flight alone.
That was great. Thank you. It's such a funny story, and I really love the surreal, Kafkaesque, dream logic nature of it. Is that the way you originally wrote the story, or did you start with a more realistic, logical draft?
Good question. No, this one always kind of had that big surreal hook right at the top. And it's flattering that you mentioned Kafka because obviously he's a really big influence on my writing.
So how are you able to do that? Can you describe how you're able to turn off the rational part of your brain to write these fantastical, surreal stories?
They're always very personal stories, but I don't really realize how personal they are when I'm sitting down to write them.
Mm-hmm.
So in hindsight, this story is very autobiographical because I wrote it when my wife was pregnant, and I, like the protagonist of that story, am a writer, and I was dealing with all the usual things that expectant parents deal with. What does this mean for me? You know, I'm handing the baton to a new generation. Does this mean my life is over? And I was dealing with all those sort of insecurities. But I didn't sit down, you know, with the goal of like finding a metaphor. I just kind of wrote what I felt that day. And it was, you know, what if this kid inside that womb is a better writer than I am? And what if he's writing right now? Of course, it ended up not even being a boy. But, you know, so your characters always, I think, whether you want to admit it or not, have something in common with yourself.
Yeah.
But I think writing from a surreal point of view, it allows me to have, ironically, enough distance from myself that I'm able to be a little bit more emotionally honest, maybe, than I would be if I was writing like a straight-ahead memoir, which is actually something I've never even attempted.
That's very interesting.
I don't know it's about me when I'm writing it. It's only like a year later when I'm reading the book on the radio and I'm like, oh, huh, that's pretty personal.
Yeah. The comedian John Mulaney says that Simon Rich is the Stephen King of comedy writing. So does that mean that Stephen King is the Simon Rich of horror writing?
I mean, I think he's worthy of maybe higher praise than that. He's one of my favorite writers ever, and really nice of John to say that about me. Stephen King is bizarrely a huge influence on my own writing, which you maybe wouldn't expect because I'm a comedy writer and King writes almost exclusively horror. One of the things that I find so inspiring about his work is that he's a genius at coming up with really excellent surreal metaphors to describe some pretty visceral aspects of the human experience. So like if you look at a book like Carrie, for example, even though Carrie's own experience is way weirder and stranger than that of any adolescent, it really captures how it feels to be a teenage outcast. I connected more to Carrie than I did to like the protagonists of, for example, like a Judy Blume novels, which are great as well. But there's something about the surrealism of King where it hits you in a more visceral level, or something like Misery, which is probably my favorite book about writing, but again told through this insane metaphor of the reader as a deranged obsessive who chains you to a bed and demands excellence.
Yeah.
So King and Kafka are really big influences on me, even though they're not straight-ahead comedy writers.
Yeah, so you see a connection between the horror and humor genres?
Oh, yeah, big time, big time.
What's the connection?
Well, I think, you know, the use of metaphor, but also just high stakes, big hooks, above all, just kind of a visceral, emotional streak that runs through it. You know, I think the best horror really hits you in the gut. You know, you really feel it on an emotional level from page one. And that's what the best comedy does, too.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite stories in Hits and Misses is called Riding Solo, the Oatsy story. Can you tell me a bit about this one?
Sure thing, yeah. So this is a tell-all memoir written from the point of view of Paul Revere's horse, who is understandably a little bit bitter that he didn't get as much credit as he feels is due for the Midnight Ride.
Yeah, would you mind reading the opening?
Sure thing.
Thank you.
Growing up horse, I do not expect much from life. My 10 older brothers all end up in stable. My sisters become glue. When I am small, my father run off. That is not figure of speech. One day, for real, he just run into woods out of nowhere. Everyone is like, whoa, that crazy. It is not happy barn. But I have one escape, running. When I am doing gallop, I do not think about how little hay we have or where I will next find salt. I think only of wind in my mane as I surge through the air like bird. In that moment, I am happy. I am free. Around this time, I meet human. His name Paul. Paul Revere. He was not big star then. He was just regular guy from Boston. Laid back, funny, easy to carry. We become close and tell our secrets. Turns out we both have same dream, to make big mark on world. One night, when moon is up, we make pact. If one of us make it, we both make it. Together, there is no stopping us. Then one day, we see British coming, and I am like, this is it. This is our chance. We can ride to town and tell people British are coming, and it will be like this big thing. Paul is scared, and he is like, are you sure that is a good idea, Oatsy? And I am like, trust me, I know what I talk about. So Paul cannot run fast because he has fat legs and also he is human. So he is like, hey, can you do running part? And I am like, of course, I will carry you whole way to town. And when we get there, you can do speaking part, since you are not hoarse and you know English and can talk. And he is like, deal.
That was great. Thank you.
Sure.
I love the diction that you've given Oatsy. I dare say that if the writers of Mr. Ed had given him that kind of diction, the show might still be on the air.
It's a great show and a missed opportunity for them.
Very well said. Many of your stories could be described as tragic comedies. Why do you often include tragic elements in your work?
It's not done intentionally, but yeah, I think you are right to say that. I guess I'm always interested in characters who are in some kind of predicament.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also interested in characters who are naive in some way. Most, if not all, of my protagonists know less than the reader knows. They tend to be inanimate objects or animals or have some kind of flaw, you know, in the case of the struggling novelist and the baby. In that story, you know, he has this deep insecurity. So I always try to write from a place of weakness and frailty. So I think that sort of lends itself to that kind of tragicomic tone. But I try to give my characters redemption most of the time. I would say occasionally one of my stories will have a pretty bleak ending, but typically the character learns something or achieves some kind of success by the end.
And as the visionary science fiction author Philip K. Dick once said, quote, "It really seems to me that in the midst of great tragedy, there is always the horrible possibility that something terribly funny will happen," end quote. And I guess it works the other way around too, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm a science fiction fan as well. You know, there's a reason why when you watch the Simpsons Halloween specials, why so many stories are modeled after Twilight Zone episodes or Philip Dick premises. There's a thin line between horror and comedy.
Yeah. You were one of the youngest writers ever to work for Saturday Night Live, and you've also worked as a staff writer for Pixar. I'm curious about how those experiences have shaped your fiction.
Well, Pixar, I think, really had a big effect on my storytelling strategy, just because they're so rigorous with their character arcs and with their narrative structure. And so I think I just learned a lot there about how to tell a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And
mm-hmm.
So I feel really fortunate for that. The big thing SNL taught me was just kind of how to imitate different idioms. You know, when you're writing like satire, it's really important to capture in a sentence a certain tone or style.
Mm-hmm.
And since my writing, you know, I tend to move around from like genre to genre, imitation is like a big part of what I do. For example, in one of my collections, I have a Sherlock Holmes story.
Yeah.
And, you know, or I'll do like a Lewis Carroll knockoff. I think I'm using those Saturday Night Live muscles whenever I'm trying to truly satirize a specific voice or writer.
Yeah, or like in the new book, the Hitler GQ parody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, celebrity profile parody about Hitler. That definitely is straight-ahead satire.
Simon Rich is the author of Hits and Misses. And remember, there are no misses when you visit us online at wpr.org/beta.
Jack Kerouac talked about writing, and he said, when you get stuck, get the picture in your mind. Don't try to think of the words and what to say, but pick it up in your mind's eye.
Sam Phillips talks about her cinematic album, World on Sticks. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. Sam Phillips has been pretty busy these days. She's been making music for television. You may know her work from the Gilmore Girls. Sam is the woman behind those distinctive musical cues, the La La songs. But she hasn't forgotten about making albums. Sam has just released her 10th studio album. It's called World on Sticks.
It was a concept that slowly gathered itself over the last few years. And I think the song or that title in and of itself is the beginning of a feeling that something needs to change, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of that uneasiness. And I think that as time went on, yes, all those thoughts came into my mind about the earth, about life as we know it.
Yeah, and you have this great quote that I read about troubles on the outside can be reflections of troubles on the inside. Can you talk a bit about that?
You know, it's funny because as a songwriter, there's an intuitive part to it that I know sounds a little bit like mumbo jumbo, but it's we have earthquakes out here in Los Angeles, and they always say that the cats can feel the vibrations of the earth. I think that dogs can too, and they start reacting before the earth, before we can feel the earthquake. And I feel like as songwriters, we're funny creatures. If we're paying attention, we can feel the rumblings of things before they hit us. And it seems that we're in a really interesting time in humanity, in this country, a very difficult time, you know, and a time of decisions, of deciding, you know, like the one song, the last song that I wrote for the record is called How Much Is Enough? And I thought that this was a good question. It deserved a song. And how much is enough? We all have to figure that out for ourselves. We have to ask that question, I think, to a lot of areas of our life or our lives, not just our political scenario here, but also how much is enough for me personally of material things, of how much can I take? How much information can I have coming at me at any given time?
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that song is that of course, is the single, and there's a music video. And it seems to me a lot of the songs deal with the damage we've done and that we continue to do to our natural landscape. But How Much Is Enough seems to be an attack on our media landscape. I'm thinking especially of the lyrics.
Someone keeps giving out the wrong numbers. We're not supposed to know what's true. Champagne promises, only red, only blue. When they break down the doors to Easy Street, will they leave anything for you? How much is enough? How much is enough? How much is enough?
And in the video for the song, we see headlines like, is civilized man losing his sense, and happiness is our business. Do you see How Much Is Enough as an attack on contemporary media?
Not an attack on contemporary media. I think it really is a question that I think everybody has to answer for themselves. I think you have to, how much can you take? How many lies can you take?
Yeah.
How are you going to find the truth? Do you have to find the truth for yourself in your life first before you can, you know, find the truth for larger situations? For instance, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Los Angeles, the air was really bad because we didn't have unleaded fuel at that time.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of smog, a lot of pollution, and thank goodness that there were people in the state that lobbied for cleaner air and regulations that had helped the cars, the fuel, everything become cleaner. Because when I was a little kid, I would have to lie down because my chest would hurt. You'd just be out playing as a kid, and it was so smoggy and so bad. You'd have to lie down. And, you know, I've realized maybe in other areas of the country, the air never got that bad because people weren't growing up in cities. And maybe when their emphasis is on, you know, jobs and money, maybe they don't understand. They've never lived through the air quality being so bad that you have to lie down because your chest hurts. And I think we have to be gentle with each other because I don't know at any point, especially on social media, I don't know what someone doesn't know. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think we have to gently bring each other along because people are fighting for what they know is right and what they think is true. But maybe we have to give this time and find out a little more about the situation before we yell at each other in cowardice on the internet.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. One of my favorite songs on the album is the opening track, Walking Trees.
Shaking from your cold lips, talking in blue. You'll keep on lying till you think it's true. Listening to your secrets, crowded by the cloud. What you're beginning to believe, you can't say out loud.
What inspired you to write this song?
Well, I'm going to live up or live down to my California upbringing. But as I was making this record, this is one of the last songs that I wrote as well. And I was passing this tree every day going to the studio. And we were going through a really bad drought in California. And it just seemed that this tree was drooping. And I started reading about trees and how they help each other with their roots underneath the ground. They can reach out to a dying tree and help that other tree. And it was funny because as soon as it started raining and he seemed happier. And I think I was imagining him also looking at me, or I imagine this situation kind of taking a little pity on the human person, you know, oh, that poor little person, like they're only around for, you know, maybe a third of my lifetime, and they'd they're all worried and they're going through what they're going through down there.
Yeah, yeah.
And wouldn't it be nicer if they could be a little more calm, if they had more perspective, if they could be, you know, up at this height, or if they could live 200 years or 150 years and have that perspective. And so I'm kind of trading places with the tree, thinking, you know, we are in a funny predicament as humans, and we are kind of like walking trees. That's kind of, that's what he would call me, you know. Oh, there's that walking tree again.
If we could find one place and grow the roots down, but we're like walking trees, we can't stay in the ground. If we could always keep moving and never stay where we are, then we have to hold to the underground to reach up to the stars. We may not have much, but we have what we need to keep walking this world until our lives are free.
A lot of the songs on the new album have this very big, very industrial drum sound. For example, the title track, World on Sticks, the drum intro has this dystopian feel to it. And yet there are also these very beautiful, very lush string arrangements on many of the songs. To me, it kind of feels like you've created this running thread of sonic cognitive dissonance over the course of the album. On the one hand, the booming drums convey this fear and this horror, yet the lush strings give us hope and optimism. Is that fair to say, or am I reading too much into this?
No, I think that's absolutely right.
Bottom of a midnight shell, underneath, it's hard to tell. Tears from water, black from blind. I'm here now, baby, but I'm gone inside.
And I think that's the teetering of the world on sticks.
Yeah.
The drums pulling it. And when I first started this record, I asked Jay Bellerose, the drummer that I've been privileged to work with for the last, you know, decade. I had him play drum performances, and then I wrote and edited to those performances. And one of the songs, called I Want to Be You, I actually heard that phrase came out of his drum playing. And that's, you know, kind of how we collaborated together. And World on Sticks was the same thing. I didn't pick up a guitar, I didn't go to the piano, I wrote to his drum track. Hmm. So it was an interesting, unusual way for me to work. I'd never worked that way before.
Yeah, and it works really well. It gives it this kind of, this sense of unity that throughout the album, that it gives it a real cinematic kind of quality, I think.
I'm happy about that too, because I think that, you know, it's interesting. Jack Kerouac talked about writing, and he said, you know, when you get stuck, get the picture in your mind. Start, you know, don't try to think of the words and what to say, but pick it up in your mind's eye. And I feel that that's kind of what we were trying to do, like the strings especially. You know, Eric Gorfain, who's a beautiful violinist and arranger. The great thing about being married to the string arranger is that I had the opportunity to really work with him, because, you know, usually, you know, string arrangers, it's not cheap, and you know, they're working on the clock like anyone else. And I got to really take time with Eric and sing him some melodies and work with him on some of these string arrangements, so that they could be evocative of what, you know, the mood or the world I was, you know, hearing in my head. So I was very fortunate. It was especially fun, this record.
Yeah, so getting back to this Kerouac idea of pictures in your mind, what kind of pictures were running in your mind when you were writing the songs for World on Sticks?
There's a song called Roll'em on the record, and that was a really interesting, like a bad dream in Las Vegas.
I look down at your funeral shoes in the white sand pocket of the neon night. Our ash-marked future knocked us blind, came up from behind. And you're looking for someone, looking for you.
This kind kind of sinister sense of things. And it's funny because I took that song to T-Bone Burnett when he was working on the second True Detective season. Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of just said to me, that's a good song. I don't know if you want it, because to have the show or have the song on the show, you'd have to give up the publishing to it. And he was saying, maybe you want to keep that guy. Maybe you want to do something with that. And I did and finished it and did this very Mancini-like, or helped me do the Mancini-like arrangement on it. And it's just, I had a lot of pictures, just flashes of this person who was trying to be charming, who was a liar and maybe a criminal, and had this kind of charisma, but was not a good person. And, you know, after 2016, if the shoe fits.
Yeah. Another standout track on the album is a song called American Landfill Kings. This one has kind of a cabaret music hall feel to it with the jaunty piano and the horns.
How did we find ourselves living on top of the things that we don't want anymore? Screaming while we cover our ears, we can't see ahead and we won't see behind us. Praying that the true false truth won't find us. They're building their dreams, the American Landfill Kings.
What inspired you to write this song?
A couple of years ago, my dad passed away, and I was going through cleaning out his place after I'd given things away and, you know, found homes for as many things as I could. There were still trucks, like three truckloads that went away to landfill, and I thought, this is incredible. This person in this small place has this much stuff that he's leaving behind that is not useful. And I started thinking about everybody in the world leaving behind, you know, all this stuff. It made me look at my possessions differently. We are such a heavy consumer society, and it was an interesting eye-opener for me. Plus, we are having a building boom, and things are going up instead of just out, which has never really been the case with Los Angeles. It's not, you know, like Manhattan in that way. Sometimes with not very much regard to what people actually need, you know, in their lives, or what cities need. A lot of times it's more about the profit. And so, yes, this is my song, I guess, in sort of protest. I don't know if any of this is protesting as much as just taking these subjects and, you know, holding them in my hand and kind of turning them around and looking at them. Like another song on the record is called Continuous Limit.
Uh-huh.
And the lyric is,
you don't have to make a living if you're alive. You don't have to make a killing before you die. Who's dreaming for me this continuous limit?
And I think that these are good questions to ask. I think I see the next generation. I see my daughter, who's in her 20s, talking about these things, you know, because in many ways the world has changed so much that there isn't a lot of the effluence that maybe, you know, or the simplicity that came before her generation. And so a lot of a lot of people are having to look at this, whether they like it or not, trying to figure out what's going to be the center of my life, what matters, you know, and how much do things matter? Should I have fewer things? Should I have, you know, how should I, what should I do for my work? Just all these questions. I think it's always good to keep the questions close to you, to keep asking the questions.
You said that one thing you shared with T-Bone Burnett is this sense of always moving forward, that just because they threw you a peanut when you did a trick, you don't have to keep doing that same trick over and over again. So I'm curious, how do you think you've moved forward with the World on Sticks album?
Oh, it's hard to put into words for me, because I think getting more complicated and yet getting simpler at the same time. I know that sounds crazy, but I think that I've always felt that streamlining the song is a good idea, to try to pack it as tightly as possible. And the old show business adage, leave them wanting more, comes to mind, that don't wear people out. I've always felt that I should make them more succinct and more potent.
I want to be you on the screen, on the street, on the stage. I want to be you in your clothes.
walls with your friends in a camera cage. I'm tired of myself, I'm tired of myself. I wanna be you. I'm tired of myself, I'm tired of myself. I wanna be you.
Sam Phillips is a singer, songwriter, and musician. She's just released her album, World on Sticks. You know, I noticed there aren't any hidden tracks on Sam's album. Or if there are, they're so well hidden that we couldn't find them. So we asked our friend Ernie Smith to help us uncover the history of hidden tracks.
As we move into the world of integral, computerized knowledge, mere classification becomes secondary and inadequate to the speeds with which data can now be processed. We are moving out of the world of data classification into the world of pattern recognition.
Tedium. It's the dull side of the internet.
You've got mail.
A hidden track is basically any piece of audio on a record that's not listed on the track list. Sometimes it can be something very short, like a vignette. It can be an actual out-and-out single that just they decided to add after the album's record sleeve had already been printed.
Do you know what the very first hidden track was?
Yeah, it was actually a Beatles song off of Abbey Road, Her Majesty. 23 seconds. Basically, the engineer that worked on that album, he actually just kind of added it without telling the band.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make her mine, oh yeah.
The Beatles being such an influence on pop and rock music and all music, I guess we could say, once that hidden track was discovered, did that cause other musicians and other bands making records to start including hidden tracks on their albums?
Yeah, it actually started a bit of a trend. It was probably more pronounced during the CD era, but there were definitely examples of this during the vinyl era. One that really kind of stands out is Monty Python. They basically created an album called The Monty Python Magic Tie and Handkerchief.
I think all right-thinking people in this country are sick and tired of being told that ordinary decent people are fed up in this country with being sick and tired.
Yeah, yeah.
I am certainly not. Well, I'm sick and tired being told that I am.
It came out in 1973, and sort of the trick of the record is that both sides of that record were listed as side two. But one of the sides of the record actually had a double groove to it.
Hidden tracks did make the move from analog records to digital CDs. And you make the argument that compact discs have more interesting hidden tracks than vinyl. Why do you say that?
There was more to mess with. CDs being a digital format, they allowed you to do things like mess with the track numbers. You could emphasize silence a little bit more. Because compact discs, they held more stuff, so you had more white space to work with. And one of the things that they messed with is called the pre-gap. Basically, what this is that if you take a CD with a pre-gap track on it, you can actually rewind it back beyond 0.00 and find a whole nother song or two.
One of the most famous hidden tracks appears at the end of Nirvana's iconic 1991 album, Nevermind. Can you tell me about this hidden track?
Endless Nameless. Basically, it shows up at the very end of the album, and Nirvana specifically designed it in such a way that it would sound like the end of the record hit. There would be 10 minutes of silence, and then all of a sudden, listener would get blasted with this loud, abrasive rock track. It became the high watermark for hidden tracks, I would really say. It was the one that really made the concept of hidden tracks something that a lot of bands did. Because it was such a popular album and because it was a relatively novel trick at the time they did it, I don't think it was intended to be anything more than just the thing that Nirvana finished this album off with. It just happened to become much more of a cultural phenomenon because Nirvana as a whole became a cultural phenomenon.
I'm guessing that since nowadays we consume so much of our music digitally, the hidden track is pretty much extinct, or is it still around? Or maybe it's around, but it's so well hidden we just don't know?
The hidden track has been replaced by the bonus track. These days, when it comes to streaming, it's harder to catch someone off guard with a piece of music. So I think that while the hidden track is less relevant than it once was, I think with streaming, it's harder to hide something on Spotify than it was on a plastic disc.
Play me again. Play me again.
Ernie Smith is the editor of Tedium, which explores the dull side of the internet. You can find out more about Ernie at wpr.org/beta. Do you think road rage is a relatively recent development? It's not. It actually goes back 200 years. Fasten your seatbelts for a guided tour of the history of road rage with Brian Smith. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Brian Smith is a writer for Mail magazine. He wrote a piece for Mail called The Fast and Very, Very Furious, Why We Get Road Rage and How We Can Stop It. He tells us what inspired him to go down this road.
I have always been taught that you can turn right on red, and so I always, when I got to a red light, I always felt like I sort of needed to do so. But mm-hmm. The problem is, in Los Angeles, that means turning on to essentially, like, you know, a freeway. And so oftentimes in my, you know, my Ford Focus, which is sort of aging, I don't feel like it can go from 0 to 50 in a matter of seconds. Yeah. So I choose not to turn right on red. And that unleashes a fury behind me. You can see the steam coming out of the cars behind me. And so that was my introduction to road rage, the things that people would shout at me and say to me as they rolled past me.
Yeah.
You know, things I probably can't repeat on public radio.
Yeah, so you've been on the receiving end of road rage, the road ragee, as they would say in traffic court. Have you ever been the road rager?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I find myself just have very little patience on the L.A. freeways, and I often will say things that I, you know, as I say in the piece, I would never comment on someone's physical attributes in real life. But in the confines of a car, you're sort of protected, and all bets are off.
Yeah. You know? Can you give me an example of your
probably not. I don't think I can.
Of your road rage at its road ragiest. You can't.
Oh, man, I don't. I mean, I told you know this balding man. I looked him right in the eye and I said that, you know, he was too ugly to find someone and he'll die alone.
Oh dear, yeah, that's pretty road ragey.
Did you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Did you feel guilty at all about saying that or no?
No, I felt pretty good.
Yeah, it
you
was
know,
cathartic.
That's kind of did what it was meant to do.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I think the beauty was that he couldn't hear me, so
yeah,
he had no idea.
Right. Yeah.
So he's just gonna die alone and have no reason why he is.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be nobody at his funeral.
Exactly.
Maybe you'll go. Maybe you'll go.
Yeah, we'll see. If the traffic's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So how far back does road rage go?
Well, from my research, you know, I found the earliest reference to it was actually an English nobleman, Lord Byron.
Oh.
And he wrote to his friend Thomas More in 1817, that last week I had a row with a fellow in a carriage who was impudent with my horse. And so I gave him a swinging box in the ear, and which sent him to the police. You know, it seems like it's been around for certainly before roads were.
Yeah. So it's kind of.
There were a couple of Chevrolet driver safety films with an old comedian named Edgar Kennedy talking about, you know, how when someone cuts him off, he shouts at someone and said, "This is the kind of guy that makes automobile people think up hydraulic brakes." You know, really laughers like that.
Yeah, when was this? This was in the...
That was in the early 30s.
I'm sitting on top of the world, just rolling along, just rolling along. Well, I'll be... He's the kind of a guy that made the automobile people think up hydraulic brakes. there! Why don't you get out and let one of those chickens drive? Yes, sir. He sure thinks he's the only fella on the road.
Yeah, and then I remembered you wrote about this Disney cartoon in 1950, which I remember, and I think a lot of our listeners will. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. It was a cartoon by Disney. It features Goofy as a Mr. Walker, kind of an everyman, good-natured suburbanite who just transforms into a monster behind the wheel, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Mr. Walker owns a motor car and considers himself a good driver. But once behind the wheel, a strange phenomenon takes place. Mr. Walker is charged with an overwhelming sense of power. His whole personality changes. Abruptly, he becomes an uncontrollable monster, a demon driver. Mr. Walker is now Mr. Wheeler, a motorist.
Hey, Jeep! Watch where you're going, stupid!
So in these two examples, the example of the Disney cartoon and the Chevrolet driver safety films with the comedian Edgar Kennedy, the term road rage isn't actually used, right?
No.
So when does the term originate?
Actually, near where I'm sitting right now in Los Angeles, in the 80s, you might recall that there were a series of violent incidents on the LA freeways of guys just... people just shooting each other. The first was this guy named Rick Bynum. He was shot and killed on Father's Day in 1987 with his 3-year-old son in the back seat. And, he was just going 65 miles per hour in the fast lane, something I do regularly. And this guy just sort of creeped up and just gunned him down. A month later, four more motorists were dead from road rage incidents. Including, the stuntmen from the Dukes of Hazzard.
Wow.
Shot while arguing, a traffic light with a bunch of teens in a Jeep.
Was he killed, the stuntman, or?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's bad. So are there statistics that indicate how many fatal accidents have been caused by road rage and whether the numbers are going up or down?
Well, the best that I could find from AAA was that it's gone up tenfold since 2004.
Wow.
It's hard to say because a lot of these crimes don't get reported.
Yeah.
And the most common reasons are weaving between lanes, cutting people off. People have been run down, pepper sprayed, stabbed, shot, even
wow.
beaten with a sledgehammer.
Oh, dear. Jeez. Yeah. So I'm curious about what causes road rage. You share in your story, you share some of the findings from a British psychologist named Peter Marsh. He co-wrote this book called Driving Passion, The Psychology of the Car. What does Marsh have to say about why driving makes us so emotional and prone to road rage?
So Peter Marsh wrote this book called Driving Passion, The Psychology of the Car. And he explains that it's actually the design of the headlights that are problematic, because they're considered these threatening eyes, which is why a lot of incidents occur when people fail to dip their high beams.
Mm.
He says that headlights give cars an animalistic quality, as do the four wheels, and so it makes it look like they're sort of horses bearing down on you.
Mm, yeah. So, and doesn't he also talk about the idea that we like view our car as an extension of our home, so we're like protecting our turf, we feel very possessive about it?
Absolutely. And so any threat to that dominance that we have, that we feel in the car, like a tailgating car, a truck flashing his high beams, it provokes this aggressive reaction with us, and it's almost sort of implicit. People are people who are usually well-mannered suddenly just, start raising fists and freaking out just because people are encroaching in your personal space.
Yeah, it's like the whole Jekyll and Hyde thing in the Goofy cartoon, in the Disney cartoon, Motor Mania.
Exactly.
Yeah. How about movies? Are there examples of road rage in the movies?
Oh, yeah. My favorite movie was actually Don John with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he literally gets out and puts his fist through a car window. But you can see road rage in Billy Madison, Falling Down, even Mr. Bean. So it's become like a Hollywood trope of sorts.
Yeah. Well, it is so dramatic, and it's so visual, so it plays well. And conflict, drama is conflict. So, yeah. What do you think we can do to stop road rage?
So I spoke to a former San Diego police officer, and he says the prime issue is that we all suffer from what's called it's the other driver's fault. Mm. And we just assume that we have nothing to do with the interaction. So he says, you know, the simple answer is to concentrate completely on your own driving and not to make eye contact with people around you. Mm. Which is difficult, obviously, because you're driving.
Yeah, but, you got it.
He suggests asking, what would the Dalai Lama do? Which is something I asked myself. The
Dalai Lama doesn't drive, I believe, right?
No, that's right.
That's the key, yeah.
That's right.
So he'd
take an Uber, probably.
Yeah, exactly. So that raises the question with all the talk, you know, and self-driving cars, could they possibly be a solution to road rage?
Well, that's what they say. A lot of people say that autonomous vehicles are the answer to a lot of human-based errors on the road, and this is certainly one of those. So it'll be interesting to see how angry those autonomous cars can get.
Yeah, exactly. It will be, yeah.
Right.
So, of course, we are living in angry times these days, and maybe all of this rage is to be expected. We have, you know, we have road rage, now we have air rage, bike rage, computer rage, rapper packaging rage, roid rage. So the rage industrial complex is huge. Do you think we've reached peak rage yet, or could we see even more different kinds of rage?
I don't know. I mean, I think the issue specifically with road rage is that it impedes normal social communication. So, you know, if someone cuts you off in a Starbucks, you know, you'll likely say, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. You know, you sort of handle it in the moment. But you can't have that interaction in the car. So I think road rage is unique that way because it foregoes the normal communication tools that we have. But, you know, I do think that, you know, as the silent sort of seething anger that we carry around, particularly men, is becoming more of an issue, not just on the road.
Yeah. This might seem like kind of a crazy idea, but maybe crazy is what it's going to take to stop such crazy, insane behavior. I want to run this idea by you. A demolition derby drive-in theater where people get to crash and bash their cars into each other's cars while enjoying some thematically appropriate films. You know, a compilation of cinema's greatest road rage scenes. We can have Don John in there. We can have Falling Down. We can have the Lynch film, Lost Highway. And then that we can also have cartoons, that Disney cartoon, Motor Mania, driver's education films. This might be a relatively in air quotes, safe way for people who suffer from road rage to get out of their system without causing too much damage or too many injuries. What do you think of this idea?
I think you're going to have some trouble finding an underwriter for such an event.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a good concept.
Yeah, the insurance premium. Well, thank you. Yeah, the insurance premiums are going to be through the roof. Yeah, so we're going to have to charge a fortune for people. Yeah. They're going to have to sign waiver forms. But, I mean, you know, all good ideas.
But it might be worth it.
It might be worth it, yeah. It might be. So maybe I should get on that. I should maybe fast-track that project. So has writing about road rage changed the way you drive at all?
I've always been a very defensive driver, thus the right on red issue. So I'm definitely aware of more aggressive drivers, more so than I have been in the past. You know, I'm aware of just of my own anger sort of brimming up to the surface, and I could sort of stop it before it comes out. But you know, I think the most common issue is people. I also wrote a story recently about wanting to update my car horn because I have a really wimpy car horn.
Oh, yeah.
So I can't even use that. You know, when people are laying on their corns and yelling at me and cursing at me, I can't even beep my horn because then they make fun of that.
Can you do an impression of your car horn?
It's like, hey! It's like really high pitched, and it's laughable, Doug. And
I'm laughing. It is laughable.
It's a problem. So the issue is that, you know, I think most common it's someone checking a text at a red light, and the light turns green, and then someone beeps up behind you, and that just creates like this visceral immediate reaction to get upset. And so I've learned to sort of tap down on that, thankfully.
Brian Smith is a writer for Mel Magazine. His story is The Fast and Very, Very Furious. God, I really early from the factory, driving like a nut in the rain. Don't think I was acting so hysterically, but I didn't see a thing until it came. Man, the dumps of purples in the takeaway, beating up the tranny at the counter. I put a few inside me at the end of the day. I took out my revenge on the rebel. That does it for this edition of Beta, the cultural cul-de-sac of public radio. Catch up on past episodes by subscribing to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to Nigel for finding Brittany to arrange for Eric to help with recording. Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Say, are you short-sighted in between the ears or something?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
There's a roadhog if I ever saw one.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
I'm walking here! I'm walking here!